Revived Thoughts is a production of Revive Studios.
This is Troy and Joel, and you are listening to Revive Thoughts, Revived Conversation.
Yeah, that's right. So this is a Revived Conversation. This is an episode without a sermon where Troy and I just talk about things that we see in church history and how they would apply to today's day and age. It's a fun time of theorizing, conversational, maybe a little friendly debate going on. Troy, how are you doing this week?
Doing very well. And you said friendly debate. I definitely remember our church conference episode was quite a long debate. So it can definitely happen. But this week, Joel, you had this idea of, I think it's a great idea, one that we should definitely talk about, which is the idea of the act of uniformity if it were passed today. And I want you, Joel, can you tell the audience what that means in your head, like what you were thinking that would mean?
Oh, boy. Troy, actually, before we jump into that, why don't you give just people the elevator pitch on the act of uniformity?
Okay.
By the way,
well, I'm not pitching it. I'm not a fan, so I'm not hoping that they're...
Sell me on it. Why should we enact the Act of Uniformity today?
So the Act of Uniformity was passed. It's actually passed more than once, and it was in effect like until the 1900s. Sometimes it's maybe even still somewhat in effect, but it's all over the place. But when we think of the Act of Uniformity, there's two main passages. There's one in the 1500s and one in the 1600s. And almost all of our times we've ever mentioned it on Revived Thoughts, it has to do with the one in the 1600s. But the idea was in England, the Church of England is connected at the hip with the king and the queen and the royal throne and who's running the church. And technically, whoever's running the church is the head also of the Church of England. And they wanted all of their ministers, all of their churches that are in England to be under the same umbrella, to be uniform, as it were, teaching the same things. They were supposed to use the same prayer book. They were supposed to be underneath the authority of the king so that he's over them, kind of. To me, as a non-Anglican, it sounds a little popey, a little bit like the Catholic Pope, except it's the king doing it instead of him. That's how it comes across when I hear that. If there's an Anglican listening, they might be able to explain to me how it's totally different and I am wrong. But again, from a very outside perspective, that is how it comes across to me. And they would have also, if you are, you know, they would have been very similar to the Reformation beliefs of a lot of people. They would have had infant baptism and things like that. But it just would have been a state-run mixture of the government that is seen in England. And this meant that you had to swear an oath, basically, to this kind of church system to do it. And in the 1600s, this was a reaction to Puritans. The Puritans had been running England after they beheaded a king. They bring the king back, and the king starts to put these acts into place. And there's multiples of them. One additional act that kind of goes along with it that we've covered is the 5 Mile Act, which meant if you were a preacher and you weren't in line with the Church of England, you tried to preach and live within your church of 5 miles, you were going to go to jail. Many of these acts were basically meant to pin down the Puritans and wipe them out by making it too hard for them to do ministry or to just straight up send them to jail. And that jail can even lead to death. We talked about how John Flavel narrowly, a guy basically tripped in front of him, and the guy who tripped got taken to jail. He didn't. And the guy who got taken to jail, he ended up catching a sickness while in jail and dying. So it's literally life or death to be thrown in jail at times. People like John Bunyan will go to jail because they refuse to get on board with this way of doing things and signing this loyalty to England. But not everyone does. And there have been people on the show that we covered that said, you know what, I will sign up to be on board with the Church of England. Ezekiel Hopkins is probably one of the more recent people that we did about a year ago who he did say, yeah, I'm with the Church of England. If there's any changes I want to make to the church, I'll do it from the inside. And so not everyone does go against the church, but this is kind of the tension that goes on. And for about almost 30 years in England, there's this back and forth over what to do. And then they kind of get passed off. But not forever. Not everybody gets on board, but most people, they kind of make some changes, allow the Puritans in. And this kind of ends the Puritan era in England after they let them into the Church of England. But again, not everybody. If you've heard of the name Isaac Watts, who wrote several hymns, including As I surveyed the Wondrous Cross, I think is his most favorite. It's the old rugged cross. The old rugged cross. No, that's not it. What is it? Okay, take that out. Don't keep that. What is it?
It's all staying in. People think that you just know everything, Troy, and you never stand corrected.
No, it was when I surveyed the Wondrous Cross. Okay, I think my brain was mixing those two songs up. But anyway, yeah, I was like, no, the old rugged cross is definitely way newer than that. So when I surveyed the old wonder, the Wondrous Cross, that old thing, you know it. And Joy to the World and a few other songs. Isaac Watts would stay a nonconformist his entire life. And he's in like the 1750s when he dies. And Matthew Henry, the commentary writer, he will die in 1710. He also will stay out of the Church of England. So not even after they start letting people kind of make their way back in and everyone's kind of coming on board again, some people they won't join back up. Matthew Henry is famous to me. And many theologian students, I once saw a guy on Twitter basically say, like, why do so many theological students quote Matthew Henry? Like, he comes up all the time. If you ever were in Bible college or in seminary, it's very common to quote Matthew Henry. And I knew the secret. I knew the answer. Why do we quote Matthew Henry? It's because when you Google Bible verses, he's usually and you put commentary afterwards, he's the first commentary that shows up because he's on like all of the Bible websites. So if you're looking for something just like, oh, I need a quick quote from somebody, you could always go to Matthew Henry would always be the first guy who showed up and you're like, he sounds smart. Let me slide him in there. So that was at least my reason for quoting him so much in Bible college. And I imagine it's the reason a lot of other people did as well.
Okay, so we have this period in the 1600s, roughly 25 years-ish, in which the government says, you can run your church, but you got to sign this document and abide by our certain guidelines, use these prayers, and the king can kind of dictate what happens in the church, and you have to decide if you're going to sign that document or not. And we see, you know, we have this hindsight, this precedent that we can look back on and extrapolate different things from, because the majority of people that we have on the show did not sign it. Some did, even though they were in disagreement to it. And then there's also others that like didn't sign it, but also didn't, like, due to their position, they could just kind of do what they want and they never ended up getting in trouble, which adds another layer of dynamic to it. Like, yeah. You could not sign it and still keep doing what you're doing and be just fine, but also you could also get thrown in prison and die or hurt the people around you in doing so. So there's uncertainty and unstableness, vulnerability that comes with it. And I don't know. I just couldn't help but thinking, again, I don't necessarily know enough about the nitty-gritty of modern-day politics to formulate a situation in which this would happen today in today's America. I don't know. I mean, some of you probably don't have to do that much thinking to think of what that would be. I'm sure there are certain other areas of daily life where an overarching law like that is more feasible. But in realms of the church, I feel like the most relatable thing in recent past might have been like the COVID debacle, right? When people, especially like up in Canada, they had a lot of issues with churches running in Canada and some pastors that were put in prison because of that. I find it interesting to look at the people. I don't know. Maybe that's speaking to my character. I don't know. What am I revealing? And now I'm talking about this. But to see someone that says, I don't agree with this, but I think this, I'd rather try to change from within and be effective in the ways that I can still be effective, relatively unhindered in the way that I still communicate and relate with people. Because 90% of ministry, you know, is that relational aspect of it. And so to choose to remain within the Church of England during that time, to maintain those relationships, to have those influences on people, even though it's within an authoritarian structure that you don't agree with, it doesn't sound crazy to me. I don't know. What are your thoughts, Troy?
Well, it's interesting to me. So before this episode, I went looking because I thought I had thought for some reason in my head, and you're, if you're listening to this and you know history, you're probably going to be like, well, you should have known it wasn't this guy. But for some reason in my brain, I thought John Owen was not, I was one of the guys who signed up with the Church of England, and he was not. He actually was a rejector. And as soon as I looked it up, I was like, of course he was. I should have known that. But the reason I thought he was is because he has this story where Charles II, the king, asks John Owen, so they're clearly on a friendly basis, and he asks him basically, why do you spend so much time going to hear John Bunyan, that tinkerer, preach? And John Owen says, I would trade all of my learning to have the same like spirit of preaching that that John Bunyan has. And to me, that's such a cool story. But in my brain, I was like, well, if he's on such a friendly basis with Charles II, that he's talking, you know, back and forth with him, clearly he must not be in trouble. But he is. He would be a nonconformist. He would have been out of the Act of Uniformity. And so then I was like, okay, well, I can't use him as my example. I need to go find somebody who was on board with the Church of England during this time. And when we were looking for that person, it took us a while to find him. And the name we came up with was Ezekiel Hopkins. I like Ezekiel Hopkins. We did an episode on him. He seems like a great guy. But he's not exactly somebody that you say the name of Ezekiel Hopkins and they go, oh, of course, I hope to grow up to have a child that grows up to be Ezekiel Hopkins. What an honor, right? Like, he's not one of the famous ministers that leaves his mark on history. John Bunyan and John Flavel and John Owen. And those guys are the ones who left a mark on history, whom we remember to this day for their bold courage.
Yeah.
And so I go, man, I on the one hand, I hear where you're coming from. But on the other hand, it does seem like those guys are the ones that God has at least honored through church history.
I would definitely agree with the sense in that those people have their spiritual reward. You know, like you say, kind of God honored them in their legacy in that sense. I don't think people that would have stayed within the Anglican Church, the Church of England there, saw this as, I think they understood that this was not an ideal scenario. They were giving up a lot. You know, like this was a bad, crappy situation. And I'm talking, obviously, those people whose theology we would agree with. There's an arc there of on the spectrum. But for those who did not agree with the Church of England and yet stayed under them to minister, I think it was like a triage situation, right? People that thought that, hey, these relationships I have with these people are more important. And I also think that maybe the sentiment that it seemed like it was probably going to be somewhat temporary, you know, like just due to the unstableness of the royalty makes it a little bit more bearable. Like if this was something that was coming in and showed no signs of ever going away, I feel like I would react differently to that than something that seemed like it was probably going to be a little bit more temporary. That also affects the dynamic of it. I don't know. But I think there, you could look at it as a very selfless way of saying, I will not find any fame or glory in this, but this is the best way for me to minister at the moment, even though it means that I'm going to be a lot more limited in the scope of history, that type of thing.
I would also say, though, that when I think of these people, these Puritans who didn't go into it, I think it is more selfless to say, you know, you have everything to lose. Almost all of these guys lost jobs, lost ministries, lost churches, and their congregants now have everything to lose by going to meet with them. But man, what an honor. Like, well, the reason we honor them and remember them is because it was the harder road, but it ends up having the more fruitful success in the long run. Because I don't know how much success the people who stayed inside the belly of the beast, as it were, actually had. I mean, I guess they might have. I'm sure the churches of England had preaching on it. But again, we can't really point to too many people that were like, wow, what a great man. We're so glad he was there. And I kind of, you know, this story reminds me of two different people that are actually not in the same situation at all. They're in the 1800s. But we've covered two different guys that they lived at the same time. They are both famous pastors, but one of them is very well remembered and one of them is not. Charles Spurgeon, during the famous downgrade controversy, which we've mentioned multiple times throughout our shows, he had to basically go up against his entire denomination of 2,000 churches and say, I think that our denomination is backsliding into liberalism and drifting away from the core tenets of the faith, and I don't want to join in doing that. And it ends up costing him an awful lot. He ends up basically stressing out. He has to take his congregation out of the denomination, and it causes a whole bunch of issues. And then at the same time, while he's doing this, there's another guy who's living at the same time. His name is Alexander White. And he never once agrees with liberalism. He never once goes in that same directional drift. He was a great preacher. We've included some of his sermons on our show, but he never called it out. He often would hobnob, you know, be friends with those same people. And even though he never called any of the liberal drift out, he just kind of stayed in the middle, stayed neutral, stay quiet. His legacy kind of goes down as, if not maybe a compromiser, at least as a guy who didn't speak up when he was needed. And it really did hurt his impact. The fact of the matter is, Alexander White is a much less famous, much less household name than Charles Spurgeon. I think it's because he kind of chose to go that road you're speaking of, Joel, where instead of, you know, I don't want to rock the boat, I'm just going to kind of quietly do my thing while everything is kind of going wrong, I'm going to focus on my people. And yes, I'm friends with these other guys who are going in that direction, but, you know, how else am I going to minister to them, kind of thing. But I think it did end up hurting his legacy a lot to not go down that road.
Yeah. And I feel like, especially in kind of the backgrounds and the circles that we deal in, Troy, we are more sympathetic and relate more with the people that would. Yeah, we relate more with the people that would defy authority a little bit to preserve the sanctity of the word of God. Like, that would be the foremost thing in our head. And I relate with that, and I understand with that. As we look at history, that's the camp that came out glorifying God more. I think that's a subjective thing, but I think we can, at least from our lens that we're looking through it.
Yeah.
There's someone that I would, as you were talking about it, that I just thought of, that I feel like, maybe this is a terrible analogy, but have you ever heard of a gentleman in not too recent past, a Mr. Fred Rogers?
Mr. Rogers fame? What church was he? Oh, yes, that one.
Yeah, Fred Rogers. Mr. Rogers. Did you grow up watching Mr. Rogers?
Boy, no. I honestly didn't like any shows with puppets. Like, I didn't like Sesame Street. I didn't like Barney or whatever. If it had puppets in it, I was just kind of like, eh, I feel weird.
I do
that
feel
a
you
guy.
A little bit. The puppet part of
the Muppets,
Mr. Rogers.
Also, all of the puppet stuff, just, I did not like it. The funny thing is, like, I never had a problem with, like, adults doing a puppet. Like, if I went to a public library and they were doing a puppet show, I'm totally fine with that. But if it was on TV, all I could think about was, like, that's just an adult with a puppet. Like, it's nothing happening.
The puppet segment was my least favorite, but I got down with Mr. Rogers as far as I got the jingle, won't you be my neighbor, you know, he takes off his shoes, feeds the fish, the whole thing, lots of nostalgia there for me. And Mr. Rogers, like, he went through seminary, has a degree as a minister, was very missions minded. And he would often get asked, like, why do you do public television when you can't talk about Jesus? Like, you can't talk about the gospel on your show. Why would you do that when you know, if you had some other platform you could be more vocal with? And he would respond, you know, like, there's no other platform that has the reach to kids that this one does. And so it was a calculated kind of trade-off that he was doing, to where I can still reach the kids with the sentiments of biblical values and what we learn in the Bible and how to process emotions and grief and anger in ways that align with this biblical worldview, in hopes that, you know, God is going to connect the dots for these kids growing up, you know, with the saving knowledge of Christ in that sense. And he could talk about, you know, Jesus in other contexts, but, you know, when he was on TV, he had these perimeters that he had to stick through. And for him, it was worth it for him to have that stage and that platform to reach people, even though it was limited in what he could say. In his head, it was worth the trade-off, worth the risk. I think that's kind of what I was imagining that sentiment being behind. Again, I don't know if that's a one-to-one comparison. We're probably going to get some people writing in that hate Fred Rogers, but
they hate. Well, I don't know a lot of people who hate Mr. Rogers, but maybe they do. I would say I think that that makes maybe sense for, especially in that era of Hollywood, because today Hollywood is pretty different. Man, this would be a good time to have Chris Wineland of Forgotten Hollywood to come on here and explain when and what, so because we used to have a show about that. But what I would say, though, is I think that makes sense for Hollywood, and I think that makes sense for a lot of different avenues. If you're an accountant and you're working at a big firm, yeah, you know what? Maybe you can't just open every accounting business meeting anyway with prayer, whatever the accountants do, okay, and I, you can't just open that with prayer, maybe, all right, maybe you have to work within the, you know, the, again, the belly of the beast. I can see that. That I feel like that is a different role, though, than ministry, and I feel like that's especially a different role than running a church. And I feel like where you are allowed to kind of not compromise at all, but to at least be a little bit more guarded and careful when you're working with these secular institutions. I feel like when you're working inside the church, when you are speaking from the pulpit, that is a place where you need to be able to be very firm in your beliefs. And if I can give a personal example, when I was younger, my family and I, we lived in China with the intention that we would go there and share the gospel. And at the time, I had worked at a Christian school up in North China, did not work out for various reasons. It was not a very well-run school. It's no longer even operational. So they had four principals in 1 year, and that kind of tells you the kind of school you were working with. So after that, I decided, okay, well, why don't I try going to a different school? Instead of a Christian school where everyone kind of already maybe has the opportunity to hear the gospel, I will go to a non-Christian school and see if I can share the gospel there. And so we moved to Hangzhou, and very big, very fancy school. I was one of the, the school was gigantic, truly a castle. Like it reminds you of Hogwarts from Harry Potter, if you've ever seen that, like giant brick school, and all of the like students were divided into houses. It was a British run school, so like a lot of those same uniforms and things were in play. It was not a British run school, sorry, it was a Chinese run school, but it was under like the British curriculum. And none of the people I worked with were Americans, and even the other foreign teachers that were there, we all were not, hardly any of them were Americans either. And so you would think, okay, now here's my opportunity to share the gospel, but there were so many rules as a school run by the communists. I ended up never even getting close to sharing the gospel with these kids I worked with, and or any of my co-teachers or any of the people other than just a couple of the Europeans I worked with. So I talked to them all day. I drove them crazy. I had so many things to say about God, and I had some really fruitful discussions with them. But at the end of that year, I looked at, okay, I tried to do it inside the system, and I was like, you know what? Not only did it not work, but for me personally, I was drained and exhausted because I felt like I'm supposed to be sharing the gospel. I'm supposed to be telling people about Jesus. But when I'm constrained in an environment where I can't freely share what I believe about God that way, it just crushed me and was very dispiriting by the end of that year. I'm not saying that God didn't use it, and I think that he did, and that there were some good opportunities there to talk to other, at least my European co-teachers. But I definitely got to the end of that year and was like, I don't want to do that again. I don't want to ever have to work for an organization that will not allow me to do what I'm supposed to be doing. And I feel like that is the way it's supposed to be for pastors and supposed to be for people in ministry. So whether or not that's true for every celebrity or every musician and stuff like that, I do think it's supposed to be true for those who are serving in a ministry capacity.
That makes a lot of sense. I do agree with the sentiment that like potential for that being a really dangerous situation, especially long term, is probably not worth the risk. You know, I feel like you make that maybe logical compromise early on, and then, oh, maybe it's not as temporary as you thought it would be, and it's lasting a bit longer, and then, oh, maybe there's a few more rules that get put in place, and then, oh, now you're a bit of an older generation, and then, oh, no, then you get a Martin Luther that's reforming the whole situation, and then, oh, it turns out you're the bad guy. You're on the wrong side of this. That path seems, very, I can totally see that going down that path.
In my early days as an advertiser, running commercials on TV was guesswork. I knew TV was powerful, but it was impossible to see which ads truly worked. So I teamed up with the best data scientists to create a better way to buy and measure TV ads. Tatari was born. Today, hundreds of brands and agencies use Tatari, and we help them optimize with metrics that actually grow the business. Learn more at tatari.tv.
And I think there is a similar parallel, at least a somewhat of a parallel to our world today, where we had the coronavirus thing. You even mentioned this. And it, obviously, the church, lots of churches reacted differently. There were churches that just never closed down, especially if you were outside of a major city. There were a lot of churches that were just kind of like, eh, whatever. And they never shut down. Nothing really changed for them. Life was pretty normal. I remember we lived, you know, with you in the same city as you, as Kansas City, and we lived in downtown Kansas City, and it was intense. Like, I remember, I'm like, it's intense in the middle of the city. And then sometimes we would just kind of, you know, drive out for various reasons out of town an hour or two, and it was as if there was never a COVID-19. Like, there was not a mask in sight. Nothing was shut down. Everything was running completely as it was, you know, a year before. And it was just so interesting to see how different places in the United States of America reacted differently. But the parallel I think would be interesting to draw is that the government was asking the churches to change how they were doing things. And that is kind of similar to the act of uniformity. And through that change, churches disagreed and they got on different sides. And you mentioned that there were pastors arrested in Canada. We actually had, I can't remember what sermon they read for us, but a congregant from one of those pastors read a sermon for us on Revived Thoughts. You know, so we've had some interactions with those kind of people who are back from those backgrounds. And the thing that's interesting to me about the parallel is in both situations, both in the COVID-19 and in the act of uniformity, you could make a very logical argument that this is for the good of the church. You could say in the act of uniformity, look at all this crazy division, all these wars that are racking Europe. All the king wants to do is get everyone on the same page so that England doesn't become united, you know, or divided. You know, England is one of the only Protestant countries in Europe. There's the Catholic threat looming large. Why can't we just get everyone on the same page? You know, why can't we just bring everyone together? And you could make a very good moral sounding argument for why all of these Puritans were in the wrong, at least at the time, to not jump on board and get, you know, the Bible talks about unity constantly, right? Why won't these guys do so? And I think you could make, you know, there were moral arguments also for why the churches should not have shut down or should have shut down. And what's interesting to me, though, is the long-term effect of that situation of having shut down and having done online church. It, statistically speaking, most churches have taken significant hits due to the who is going anymore. Congregations shrank, and a lot of them never recovered, and a lot of churches shut down completely from that era. So even though there may have been good reasons to do it, you may have thought, the long-term effect from joining in for the churches that did, it has been a lot of them really did struggle and are struggling. And when I talk to people, there still is a little bit of just like, we have not really fully returned to, not every church, there are lots of churches that are doing even better than before, but there is definitely a lot of churches that kind of closed down forever during that era. So I feel like there's that parallel of at least a danger when the government and church are interacting, where maybe it was unavoidable, but it certainly seems like it caused some of that, if that makes sense.
Definitely, yeah. And it's always a downside, you know, whenever there's any parameters or limitations that you're having to interact with or work around, it's never good. But where's the line? You know, like, I feel like that's the hard part of the conversation, is because I absolutely agree with the sentiment that, like, we need to preserve the independent authority of God, you know, as the utmost primary, you know, thing that we have to do. And so we can't let stuff get in the way of that, because everything suffers when that happens. When do you step in and say no? You know, like, when do you step in and say, you know, like, where is that line? And that's different for everyone. That's different for every church. That's different, like, depending on the meeting. And you, no one's thrilled with it, but you kind of, you know, like, put up with it for a little bit. But then, like, how long is too long? And then, again, yeah. You can very easily see that scenario where, oh, you know, enough time goes by and you end up on the wrong side of history because you put up for it for too long.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's tough. It's a tough situation to be in.
So what's interesting is, let's use the COVID example. I remember during that time when people were talking about churches shutting down, I remember I had a friend of mine explaining it, and he said to me a line that he didn't know was wrong, but he said to me, he said, like, hey, you know, the churches of China are willing to, you know, would love that all you ask them to do is, you know, do these couple of hoops and you could keep your church open, but, you know, you'll have to do these things. And I said, I was like, actually, you're not quite correct, because in the underground churches of China, they were asked, I think it was in the year 2017, by the government of China at the time. And the government of China said, underground churches, if you will just come out and tell us who is going to your churches, we will let you operate freely. That's all we ask, is if you could just tell us your names. And they said, basically, this is your chance, underground churches, to get a free blank slate. No one will be in trouble. No one will go in jail. All of you are free to come out now. We will let you do, you will let you run your churches out in the open. We just ask that you would please tell us who you are. And the underground churches of China said, no, China, we're not joining you in that. Absolutely not. You're sorry. We're going to continue to stay underground, because we know that once you know who we are, it's game over for us. Because whenever you change your mind, you can come back and shut us down. So it's funny to me, because it does depend on your context. For the Church of China, I mean, it was, no, we won't even give you our names. We will not interact with the government on any kind of a trustworthy level, because we don't trust the government at all. And so they stayed in hiding. When for us, if America were to give out that thing, I think a lot of us would go, that's not so bad. Just give them your name, right? Like, that's not such a big deal. And so it was just interesting to me. Like, the church is divided on this issue of what is acceptable and what is not. And of course, obviously the churches in China have dealt with a much more severe authoritarian government that has wanted, and it was kind of a trick, by the way, that lo and behold, when those churches that did come forward, China almost immediately started seizing and causing problems. So yes, it was not actually a genuine offer of freedom. It was, they were right, I think, to say, no, we're not going to give you our names, because we know where this is going afterwards. But it's just interesting to me how around the world people are willing to put up with different things and look at it differently. And one aspect of this that's kind of lost is these people were willing to say no to the acts of uniformity, and they then went out of their way for 25 years to live their lives outside of the acts of uniformity. And those who didn't, I mean, people around that era were moving to the, you know, to the colonies of America, where, I mean, in some cases, 1/3 of the people were starving or dying, or 1/8 of the people is a very high number. And they did it all because they wanted to run churches that they thought were following God, to get away from these other state-run churches. And I, you know, here's the question today. Do we take church that seriously? Like, would we be willing to do those? Can we even imagine crossing the Atlantic Ocean on sailboats to set up new colonies just so that our church worship could be the right kind of church worship? Or hiding in forests and meeting in barns at midnight in the middle of the night for years because our services can't be held out in the open? I think that part of the reason this conversation is almost hard to have for us today is because we're so different from that group of people. And I think most Christians, the answer is no, not really. I would just go along to get along. I probably can't even imagine taking church so seriously that I would risk my family's life just to have the right kind of church. I think a lot of us today would go, look, this state-run church isn't perfect, but it's good enough. Why don't we just stick with what we have and not rock the boat too much? And I'm not saying that to insult us. I'm willing to say that I'm probably in that boat of people who would have a hard time seeing it. And I have to say, I think we've lost some of that passion where we are willing to cross oceans and build countries and meet in barns at night and hide ourselves and do those things just to make sure that our church is the right church.
You know what I think my biggest takeaway from this conversation is?
What's that, Joel?
The need for community within your believers' friend group, you know? Like one of these topics, you can think about hard and come to a conclusion in your own mind, and it may or may not be the right one, but I feel like the more people you have around you that are surrendered to God and in step with the Spirit, the more a counsel that you get, the better chance you have of living a life that is honoring to God is. And so when you might not be convinced or you know, assured of things, but you have four or five trusted men of God around you that do seem convinced, you know, like things like that. And talking about it with you right now, you know, you think about things in different light. You think about things that you wouldn't have otherwise. And I feel like, yeah, there's a tremendous need, and that's an area where something is lacking in a lot of churches, is they just have their own internal little echo chamber of self-affirming thoughts and processes, but I do think it's good to get outside your bubble and talk with other people that, again, are in step with the spirit and hear their input on it, and be humble enough to let that consider an influence. Because if I'm in a situation where I feel like I'm doing something that's right, but there's seven friends around me that I trust, that I love as brothers in Christ, and they're counseling me against it, I mean, I got to be spiritually mature enough and man enough to trust that the Lord is using them to talk to me about whatever, you know, whatever that is. And so, yeah, I don't know. That was just something that came to my head is, man, imagine going through something like this without spiritual friends. Like, that sounds miserable.
Well, and I do think, too, just also, if you're going through this and you end up like the Puritans on the wrong side of the law, and you're on the, man, like, read the stories of people like John Flavel and these John Bunyan and these guys, and you can really tell it is the friendship and the community of the church that keeps them going. Like, they would not have made it through those hard times had they not had the bonds, the networks, the connections, the friendships that were keeping them strong and in the faith. So I definitely agree with that, Joel. Like, we need to. We need the community. We need each other. And when those hard times come and when we're going through these difficult eras, those are the people that will keep you going through it and keep you from going crazy, keep you from going and looking around and going, what has happened in the world, you know, and keep you from getting those discouraged thoughts. And it physically, in the case of several of the guys of the Puritan era, keep them going, like keep them hidden or keep them fed or keep them a safe house they can run to in the middle of the night. When the King's guards show up. So it can be both a very emotional keep you going, but you never know. You never know what 20 or 30 years might bring, and it can also be a physical keep you going as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I was approaching it just from like a council standpoint.
I know you were. I know you were. I was just thinking, but to add on, here's some other reasons that are also very encouraging, because I think that you're completely right. It's a spiritual, it does add that element as well. But it is amazing to me how deep the friendships of those Puritans seem to be, like the letters they would write to each other and just the camaraderie they would have of going through those hard times together. And not like you're jealous, but you're just like, man, like these guys were really tight. They were going through something hard, but they had each other's backs. And I think that's something that if hopefully it never comes to that, but if it ever does, hopefully we all have people like that, that we can do that ride or die with as well.
Ride or die. All right. I don't have anything more to talk about. Do you have anything more you want to talk about, Troy?
Nothing else to talk about. We are assured that this episode is going to be one of those non-controversial ones, because we only talked about COVID and a bunch of other things. So I'm sure this is not something that will in any way ruffle any feathers. But if you have any thoughts you'd like to send our way, any of your thoughts on the Acts of Uniformity, send them to revivedthoughts@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to another classic Revive conversation. This is Troy and Joel, and this is Revive Thoughts.
In my early days as an advertiser, running commercials on TV was guesswork. I knew TV was powerful, but it was impossible to see which ads truly worked. So I teamed up with the best data scientists to create a better way to buy and measure TV ads. Tatari was born. Today, hundreds of brands and agencies use Tatari, and we help them optimize with metrics that actually grow the business. Learn more at tatari.tv.